Today, we're joined by Mark Suman, CEO of Maple AI and former Apple engineer. Mark dives into why privacy is the key battleground in the AI revolution, how open source models can deliver a truly personal AI experience, and the game-changing potential of integrating Bitcoin into AI payments. Get ready for a powerful conversation on building AI. As a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. If you enjoy our content, please remember to like, share, and subscribe, as this all helps us greatly. Our DMs are always open, and we welcome feedback and comments. Thank you.
This isn't for everyone. It's for the ones who know the old system is broken and are ready to build something that lasts. Welcome to the Build with Bitcoin podcast.
Welcome to Build with Bitcoin. I'm co-host Israel Munoz, and joined with co-host Lynn Bairstow today, we have the immense pleasure of welcoming Mark Suman, CEO and co-founder of Maple AI. Mark, we're incredibly excited to get into today's conversation because we're talking about some very important topics. Two very important technologies that we like to cover are, of course, Bitcoin and AI. You have some philosophy from the Bitcoin ethos incorporated into everything you're working on with bringing privacy to this AI revolution, let's say. All that to say, welcome, Mark. It's going to be a great conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
You have an impressive background working on computer vision, privacy. You spent some time at Apple working on machine learning. Give us a little insight into, and I believe this was early 2000s. So before we were even talking much about privacy, but what's your story with privacy and how you got involved with Apple?
Yeah, I have, my journey and my career has been at like various different corporate stages. So the first company I joined right out of college had just been acquired by a major tech company, EMC, which is now Dell EMC. And this company was called Mozy, and it was an online backup company. And so I'll chat a little bit about that. But I'm like, after that, I went and we started something called Instructure Canvas, which most universities use today for doing their learning management system. So really got involved in the ed tech space. I was there when we were just 8 employees, and eventually grew that and went public on stock exchange and had a good successful trip there. But then I've also worked at really, really small app shops where we were building software for kids who have speech impediments and going through speech therapy and doing some cool, innovative things there. And then joined Apple and was working on some of the biggest platforms in the world that are going out to hundreds of millions of users and working on AI, machine learning, and privacy stuff there. So I've kind of seen things at all sorts of different sizes and different corporate structures. And now I'm here doing my own thing with a co-founder working on AI. So going back to the beginning, like how did I get involved in privacy in the beginning? And that was at this company called Mozy, where you would pay $5 a month, you would back up your entire computer. And this was back in 2009. When, we take for granted now this whole cloud thing that like all of our devices are constantly connected to the cloud, all of our stuff, whether it's in Google or whether it's like iCloud photos, we just assume when we capture some piece of information, it's always ever present on all our devices and always backed up and it's going to be there for us. That used to not be the case. It used to be that you just put everything on your laptop or everything on your home PC. And then if something happened, if you had a hard drive crash or somebody broke in or whatever, that stuff was gone forever. So we made it super easy. We built this big distributed cloud, and you would back up your computer for $5 a month. And what we had was, some people had no problem doing that, but other people were a little concerned about their privacy because you're backing up financial statements, you're backing up your family photos, you're backing up very sensitive personal information. And so we offered our customers this private key where they could generate their own private key or, create their own whatever, and then they store that at home. And for anybody who's into Bitcoin, this sounds very familiar, right? It was a private public key pair, and they would encrypt it first on their device before sending it to our cloud servers, and so we didn't have access to that. I was working on the client for Mac computers, Mac OS, and I would, as an engineer, sometimes I would get pulled into support calls, and the support team would be like, we don't know what to do here with this person. Will you help them get their files back? Something happened. They need to restore their files. And so I would get in there and I'd be working with customers. And if they did not use this private key thing, if they just used our normal shared encryption key, I could see all of their family photos. I could see all of their documents. And it felt very creepy to me that I would just open up this thing and they would ask me, the customer would be like, hey, are my family photos there? Like, will you please open some of them? And I had their consent. So I'd open these photos and it's like, I'm looking at your family vacation. And I'm glad that I only opened a family vacation one. There could have been other photos there that I shouldn't be seeing at all. And that was when I first had my light bulb moment that like, hey, the cloud is not like this magical place of security with military grade encryption, all this stuff. The cloud is just somebody else's computer. And if you're copying your files to somebody else's computer, that person can see them unless you use encryption and start the process at your device with your own personal encryption. So yeah, that's really where my journey started. And I carried that through all the jobs that I worked on and in different fields of education and at Apple, all the stuff going on there.
I'm going to also ask you about your first interaction with Bitcoin, because you referenced Bitcoin and we're going to get into this in throughout the conversation. But how were you introduced to Bitcoin, or at what point? And did you make that link between the private public key pairs that you'd been working on and what the Bitcoin technology was based on?
Yeah, like many people, my first introduction to Bitcoin was not when I really grasped it. Some people are awesome. Some people like read the white paper or had a friend tell them and just like immediately got it. I was introduced while I was working at Instructure. A friend of mine, in that previous company, Mosey, Adam Back was actually involved in an acquisition that got brought into the same business that we were in. So there was a little bit of, familiarity from that perspective. But it wasn't until probably 2013 that one of my friends at work did just like a lunchtime brown bag presentation about Bitcoin. And then after he told us all about it, then he gave us a little strip of paper. He like cut up little paper wallets that were about this size and handed them out to everybody that was there. And I think it was like 0.1 Bitcoin on each paper wallet. And I literally took this little paper wallet and I stuck it inside my physical wallet and said, this is cool. I've got Bitcoin in here. And I would just like joke with people, later on when I'd see them, I'd be like, hey, I've got my dollar bills and look, I've got my Bitcoin right here too, next to my paper money. And it just kind of sat there for a while. And it wasn't until like 2016, 2017 that I really got more into it and started understanding more of the philosophy behind Bitcoin. And that's when I was hooked on it and have just been kind of in the space ever since.
Lynn and I are partners at Baselayer Advisors, where we use our network of venture capital partners and startup founders to connect investors with unique opportunities within the Bitcoin innovation space. Alongside this, we help startup founders with their growth and fundraising. Visit our website's advisory section to learn more.
I found it very interesting listening to some of your other interviews, Mark, because I was surprised with how many conceptual overlaps there are, with a lot of these things that people in the Bitcoin industry are very familiar with, such as, don't trust verify and not your keys, not your coins. It's clear that there's a very direct link to a lot of the work that you're doing with Maple AI and the privacy and sovereignty side of this, AI movement. But before we get into a little more of that philosophical stuff, at what point did you decide to leave Apple? I mean, one of the most iconic companies of our times, of course. Was it just your time had come, or was it a deeper calling, let's say, that you saw the importance with everything going on with AI and given your privacy background that you decided to eventually launch Maple AI? I guess what made you take that leap?
Yeah, it was actually Bitcoin that got me to take that leap. I was very happy at Apple. It's a great company. There are a lot of awesome people that work there. And I was working on new cutting edge technologies. Like my last thing that I did is I helped launch the Vision Pro before I left. Now the Vision Pro, whether or not you think it's a great product, that's a different story. I was working on these frontline things that we had going. And I really, I kind of looked at some of those new projects. I had worked on every iPhone launch during my time there as well. So I was like, okay, I'm on these like front lines of new cutting edge tech. There's got to be Bitcoin going on here. So I started looking for a Bitcoin team within Apple. And I can't say whether or not there is one, but that's really what I wanted to do. And so I wanted to find ways to make Bitcoin more mainstream from a UX perspective, right? Make these apps that are more approachable, make services that are more mainstream for people, because I could see that Bitcoin was a protocol, Bitcoin was a technology that really could enable so many things. And it shouldn't just be viewed as like this niche, get rich quick scheme that, that people just buy and hold forever and that's it. I saw that there were definitely technical applications for it. And so that's when I was really getting involved in the local meetups here in Austin. I was going to BitDevs all the time. And I had gotten to know Tony and some others through those meetups, just being around them. And then I attended at South by Southwest last year. So this would be March of 2024. For whatever reason, I don't know why South by Southwest doesn't really like Bitcoin. They like all the crypto projects, right? But they never admit Bitcoin talks into there. So us Bitcoiners, you know, we've taken it upon ourselves to do our own thing. So Parker Lewis and the Bitcoin Commons people have done a great job setting up an adjacent mini conference there. And so I went and listened to Anthony speak at Bitcoin Takeover at South by Southwest. And it was kind of after that that I was like, okay, I really want to join with the Mutiny guys because I like what they're doing. And I think I can bring my experience and my skill set into this. So that's where we really got started. We went out, we chatted, we had drinks together. We just kind of like explored what would it be like to join together. And so I joined up with the Mutiny guys. And then you've probably, you know, learned all the stuff that's gone on there, but it was all really good. And everybody's like nice to each other and all. There was no falling out. It was just Mutiny Wallet as a product. We didn't see a strong future for revenue growth there. It was an awesome app, but a super technical, a difficult technical problem to solve. And so we decided that we needed to wind down Mutiny. And two of the guys left to go pursue other opportunities on good terms. And it was Anthony and I, and we said, okay, listen, Mutiny was this awesome thing because it had strong privacy and it gave people sovereignty over their Lightning wallet. And they had built this really cool cloud that was this this encrypted backend, if you will. Everything was encrypted locally on the device before it was sent to the cloud, which if you're listening here, that's like how we built Mozy with the online backup. So there was a lot of overlap there in the technology. So we started figuring out what are we going to pivot to next? And we started meeting with developers. I'm a product guy. So it's like, let's just start talking to users. Let's start talking to people. We had a lot of calls with people. And the thing that kept coming up time and time and again is we want a private version of ChatGPT. We would use that if that was made. And we had obviously been using AI a lot because it's a new technology. And we said, this seems like a really perfect pairing of the two because we're all giving away our data to Sam Altman, who is Mr. WorldCoin, scan your eyeballs with the orb. Like, I never want people to forget that. That is like so important to remember with the ChatGPT story, that he wants to capture everybody's retinas and identities and tie it to their thought process. And there's a whole like dystopian world you can explore if you marry those two together. So we wanted to offer the alternative. There's an escape hatch. You can have sovereignty over your AI, but you can also have powerful cloud AI. And we're trying to bring those together in a really easy to use package that can be a true rival to something like ChatGPT.
I love that you're talking about this because it's just so important. And I mean, just listening to you talk about when you used to have all of your information on your own, you know, in your house, like I had my own server, and then I was actually very excited when the cloud arrived and I could just transfer, you know, everything, you know, when you upload a new phone and you have all your information without having to go through the gymnastics of when you're traveling, of taking the files that you need with you off of your desktop to your laptop. And it feels like we're now going to personal servers once again, because of these concerns with privacy. We are just giving up so much of everything that we have and trusting these large corporations that make their revenues based on data and culling your own data without necessarily specifically giving permissions. I mean, I think, you know, you get a screen that says we've updated our terms and conditions and you just click yes, and you don't really know what's going on with your data. Can you drill down a little bit more about how Maple AI works and how it is different than these models that we're all automatically just flocking to because we believe they're improving our productivity and giving us, you know, more hours, but what are we paying in exchange for that? In addition to the $20 a month.
Yeah, definitely. Maple is trying to follow kind of the older model, and it's not bad because it's old. It's just a model that we all left behind about 20 years ago. And that is, users pay for a service, you give them that service, and you just kind of stop there, right? And it's a good healthy model where Maple, you pay $20 a month, we give you access to these very powerful open source models. So we have DeepSeek, we are adding KimmyK2, which is like the big new reasoning model in the open source space. We have GPT-OSS from OpenAI, which is open source, Llama from Meta. We have the Google Gemma one. So we're trying to grab from all the big frontier shops. We're grabbing their best AI, open source AI stuff that they have. And then we give you this really easy to use application that's on the web. It's on your desktop. It's on your phone. And all of your chats are synchronized together. But we can't see what you're chatting about. We don't know the conversations that are going on in the AI. It's really as if you walk into a room, you and this bot, and you close the door behind you, and you have this private conversation, and nobody else knows what you're talking about. And it's not because you're talking about nefarious things, you're talking about bad things. It's because you deserve to have that privacy. Everybody has the human right, really, to have a private conversation with another individual. And that individual can be a human, or that individual could be a computer. And that computer is a reasoning model that helps you kind of think through your thought process. So with Maple, we give you, you know, chatting with an AI, we let you upload images to do image analysis. So that can be like, what is this plant that I'm looking at? Or it can be, what is this thing on my skin? I don't know what this is, right? Help me walk through this. There are all sorts of things that people do with that. We let you upload documents. So, you know, I had a friend who was getting evicted from his apartment, and he thought maybe his landlord wasn't doing something that was within the agreement. So he uploaded his rental contract to it and was able to chat with the AI about his rental contract. We have law offices that are doing the same with their client information and uploading it to Maple, but it's fully end-to-end encrypted. And so we're not breaking that client attorney privilege with them. What else can we do? We do voice as well. So you can talk to the AI, and then that way you can use a more natural, you know, flow of thought with voice. We're really just trying to add these features that people really want out of their AI, but do it in a way that is fully private.
There's a lot that I want to get into. Let's start with the more practical stuff. So as far as your use of various open source models, I think, you know, maybe one obvious that question that comes to mind for anyone listening or for interested users might be, okay, how does this stack up to these other very powerful models that I've heard of or that maybe I've used? You know, from personally, I can speak to, let's say, I really liked Grok for their kind of for certain reasoning and deep logic tasks. I've enjoyed Claude for when I want to mix some logic reasoning with design capabilities. So we've also seen how they stack up against each other. The open source models that you're plugging into at Maple AI. So I guess two-part question. Open source generally, how is that evolving and how is that comparing to these other well-known leading models in the AI space? And do you see it as a benefit that you have that flexibility to be plugging into various of these open source models? And how does a user know which one to pick, or do you do that for them?
Yeah. No, it's a great question. It's something that people are always wondering about. And when a lot of people think of open source AI or when they use open source AI for the first time, it's usually something that they downloaded on an app on their phone. So they went on, they found some local AI app that they can run, and they download a very small model onto their phone and run it. And it's slow, it's inaccurate, and it's made a lot of trade-offs because it's tried to take the entire brain of the world and compress it down into like 2 gigabytes. To run on commodity hardware on a phone. Whereas when you use ChatGPT, they're running a model that has trillions of parameters. It's this massive thing. It runs on multiple large GPUs at once. You have to chain these GPUs together in order to get anything out of it. And so there's like this huge gap of what people perceive to be open source AI and the frontier proprietary AI. And then there is the open source AI that we're running, which we run the largest models that you can get from open source. And so they actually are far over on the spectrum toward the frontier proprietary models. These are billions, hundreds of billions of parameters, getting close to the trillions of parameters. And they're they're quite good. Now, you can look at benchmarks. People like to talk about benchmarks, OpenAI, Grok. They all talk about them, Claude, and they're all great models, and they all hit these benchmarks really well. But then you also need to look at how does it actually work for you as a user. Now, the open source models are scoring really well on a lot of these benchmarks. Qwen is another one that we run. Qwen has done very well on the programming benchmarks with Qwen 3 Coder. And then Kimi K2 is starting to score really well on reasoning and other things. So they're moving up on the leaderboards, if you will, toward these frontier proprietary models. But when you use them, just see how they work for you. We find a lot of users say, you know what, I thought that they were going to be awful, but they're actually really good and they get me what I need. And the analogy I like to use is if you're driving to work or you're driving your kids to school, you could pick the most powerful muscle car. You could pick a Ferrari, or you could pick an F1, you know, race car to drive your kid to school, or you could pick the car that just works really well for your family and gets your kids to school, right? And you don't need to necessarily have that like final 3% of horsepower or something in your car. These open source models have become so powerful now that that they really do work for the everyday use case just as well as you would get in some of these other platforms.
Touch on something that you brought up that I think is really, really important that I think few people think about very much as they're turning over their data. And that's the companies behind these LLMs and what their ethics are and their models are. In the case of OpenAI, Israel and I, neither of us use ChatGTP intentionally because I'm just so against the trajectory of that company and the connection with WorldCoin, to your point. Very few people bring that up, which is a company called Tools for Humanity. And, you know, and I think very few people give thought to which LLM they are connecting with. And that's the one that I would avoid at all costs because it's the one that I don't want to give my data up to. I love the fact that Maple can take any one of these models, whether it's Meta, whatever you think about that company, and Llama, their open source LLM, or OpenAI, or Anthropic, or Google. And how do you think about the company behind the bringing together of all this data and how it's used, and how dedicated are they to open source versus whatever they may be developing on their own?
Build with Bitcoin is a proud affiliate partner of River. River is a financial services company that allows you to purchase, sell, and transfer your Bitcoin all through a great suite of products, high security standards, and as of recent, even allowing you to earn a Bitcoin yield on your US dollar cash deposits. For a personalized onboarding experience, go to partner.river.com/buildwithbitcoin.
Yeah, there's a lot there. Some of these places that we could go there with that. So first and foremost, like I've said this on a previous show, is that you don't really know the employees that are working at that company. For example, when I was back at Mozy and I was helping some customer who contacted support, and they were having me look through their family photos. That customer didn't know me at all. They didn't do any kind of background check on me. They don't know what my history is or anything. Now they're trusting that the company did a background check on me, sure. But if you are dealing with sensitive data, whether that's just your own personal data or you're actually using your client's information within AI, you probably vet the people that you work with on your team very closely. We talk about this with activists a lot. So we do a lot of work with the Human Rights Foundation, and we meet with activists and their organizations, and they very strictly monitor who they work with for obvious reasons, right? They don't want state actors coming in and being part of their organization that are working against them. So you put a lot of effort into that, but then you kind of like poke this hole in the wall of your firewall that you've built and start giving your information away to ChatGPT or Anthropic or any of these other companies where you don't know who's working there, and they could have state actors there working against you. So that's an extreme case with activism, but it really plays through to everything that you do. So the answer that we give people instead is, why not just make your data private from the beginning and then use these powerful platforms? So that way you don't even have to actually trust the company that you're dealing with. And we don't want to read your AI data. We don't want to read your chats. We don't really want to know what's going on. We just want to sell you really good service and have people be happy with the service. We're pitched as private AI. That's, if you go to our website, we are private AI. But really what I love to tell people is that we're actually the most personal AI that you can have. And what I mean by that is we have our users come to us all the time and say, you know, I was using ChatGPT or I was using Google, and I just never really felt like I could talk openly to these because I knew in the back of my mind that there was somebody watching everything I was saying. I knew that it was being recorded. And then you hear Sam Altman go on podcasts and talk about how ChatGPT stuff can be used in a courtroom. So if you are ever taken to court, like your own ChatGPT chat logs can be used against you from the other side. So people are self-censoring when they use these platforms, whether they realize it or not. And they tell us, when I started chatting in Maple, I suddenly realized that I was like saying things that I had been holding back. And the dilemma that we have with AI that a lot of people don't realize is you need to give more information to AI. The more detail, the more personal information you can give it, the better results you're going to get out of AI. That's how it's built. That's how it's supposed to work. And if you're using a platform where you're holding back because you don't trust the company you're using, you're not going to get the best results out of that. And so people are getting better results within Maple because they're able to be themselves and be most personal or be the best person for their client that they brought into their company. So really it's this dichotomy, this thing where you can self-censor or you can really just be yourself and get the best results possible. I don't know if I touched on everything there. If there's something else you want to go down, we can chat about that too.
You know, that's a fascinating point, Mark, because I mean, so personally, I have experienced what you just mentioned where I hold back. And I think people either fall into category A, you are holding back on the information you're providing because you have these kind of privacy concerns in the back of your mind. And even when I hit the, you know, private chat function that all of these models have, right? I mean, ultimately, you're still left with that question of, like, I don't actually know what's going on in the background. So you're probably in category A, where you're holding back information, or you're in category B, which is, you know, even more concerning, which I would say probably a lot of people are in this category of they don't hold back, right? I mean, they just don't think much about the implications of this. And we've seen this story unfold before. I mean, this is what's, I think, both important and you've described this new front, this AI as kind of this new frontier. And the importance of all of this is just so large because, I mean, the story that we've all, you know, lived through in the last 20 years is, you know, let's take the Facebook example. And regardless of what their intentions were in the beginning, you know, and I do believe that they probably were out in the beginning to just create a great social network product and connect people through the internet. But of course, we know how that all unfolded. We know how, looking back, we've all given up, you know, all of like these companies now know exactly who we are, what we looked like when we were, you know, 25, 40 years old. They've seen all this progress. They know exactly, you know, what your emotional journey was. They know everything about you, right? And now we've also seen, especially in the recent, you know, political turmoil that we've lived through in the recent years, that politics, of course, ended up, you know, getting in bed with big tech, and these algorithms were very easily manipulated and has had massive social consequences. So all that to say, we've seen the dangers of handing over your data, right? But it's a fine line because, I mean, I think the story, my takeaway from the, you know, the social media stuff is it was just so practical and such a good product so quickly, delivered so quickly that people just, we didn't think much about it, right? And I fear we're kind of going through that as well right now with AI. I mean, we're recording here end of 2025, and 25 has been just an impressive year on the traction and growth of these products. It was just the year that suddenly everyone's like, oh, wow, you know, AI, I'm so much more productive. I'm going to use it. I need to use it for everything. And so how do you think about this timing, Mark? I mean, it's crucial that we start to remember some of the lessons that we should be learning from the social media journey, and the importance of not handing over your data. And you just hit on a few of those points. But, you know, how do you think through that timeline that we're in?
Yeah. So the first, I want to talk about that temporary chat thing you brought up with the other tools. And this is a great segue into the question you just asked. And that is, We have to read the privacy agreements. We have to read kind of the terms of service, because the temporary chat feature that Grok and OpenAI and others have, even though it disappears from your screen when you're done chatting, they retain it for 30 days on their servers. I know specifically ChatGPT does this. I haven't read Grok's terms. I need to go look at theirs, but specifically ChatGPT keeps it for 30 days. So even though it's something where we feel like, oh, it's temporary or it's private, it's not fully private. They hang on to it. And then with the New York Times lawsuit that they have with OpenAI, they're finding that they're being told by a judge to retain data even longer than their terms of service. So those are just business promises that can be changed on a whim in a court of law, which again is why we try to encrypt everything so that so you don't have to depend on that. Now, looking at kind of this whole social media journey that we all went through, we've all kind of felt what it's like to use social media and be on that algorithm and doom scroll and all that stuff, and how we like emotionally feel afterwards and how we physically feel afterwards. And the more time you spend in those, usually you feel almost worse about yourself afterwards. And we've seen the division that can happen from these platforms, and how we feel more politically divided than we ever have before. A lot of that comes down to how these algorithms were built to maximize screen time, maximize profit, and then maximize directives maybe that organizations are given by either investors or state actors. And what has been well documented now is that they employ these technology, these methods of things like anchoring bias, where they feed you a data point that isn't totally true, but it sets your anchor now. And then anyone trying to dispel that falsehood now has an uphill battle to fight, because they have to move you off of this anchoring spot that wasn't even the right spot to begin with. And they repeat things. They change the timeline that you're getting so that maybe you are given something that makes you feel awful before you see some good news. And now you don't really receive that good news well because you're feeling awful. So there's all sorts of tricks that they can play to kind of manipulate your mood that you're in. These are all possible to do within AI. But they can happen so much faster and so much better. If you look at your emotional well-being, social media learned pretty well how people were. And so their algorithms could get pretty good at trying to like lead you along. Now, AI is learning you on a whole different level because it's getting into your mind, all of your thoughts. You're dumping everything you're thinking about, everything you're trying to do, the keystrokes that you're typing. They're capturing those keystrokes and kind of the emotions really around like how fast you're typing and what you're deleting and what you're not sending. There's all sorts of rich information they're gathering. This allows the AIs to know like, okay, each one of us on this call, we have different ways that we are gullible. We have different ways that we can be convinced of something. So if I am an advertiser, if I'm a company who wants to market to all three of us on here, I don't have to create a single ad that shows up on a timeline on social media. I don't have to create a single TV ad spot that goes out to millions of people. I can create an ad and then have the AI tailor it to each one of us and have a much higher success rate of selling us on that product. And so if that's possible with marketing, then that could be possible with propaganda. That could be possible with any other thing that you want to do to try and convince a general populace of something, could be deployed through these AI platforms. And we are, like you said, I think we're naively just giving over all this information, not realizing kind of the system that we are potentially walking into and setting up, because we're dealing with all of these closed proprietary systems. We can't see the code. We can't see what's running on servers. We can't see what data has gone into training these models, et cetera, et cetera. There's no verifiability throughout the system. And so we're unable to suss out and determine if that is happening or if it's going to happen.
I want to just pull on that thread a little bit more. And you talked about retaining the data, even though you think it's disappearing, for at least 30 days. And we're talking, I think we've been talking up until this point, pretty much U.S.-centric or Western-centric. And Israel and I, our audience does reach quite a bit into LATAM because of our connections here. I'd like you to just broaden this out and just talk about what are the potential risks of giving your data on a global level. So, you know, it could be one thing if you're in the U.S. I mean, and I know you've mentioned before that the U.S. government has actually made investments into a lot of these large or partnerships into a lot of these large tech companies for their, specifically with these LLM projects. But, you know, when you're talking about a more precarious government or a government that is more censor prone, for example, Maple, I believe, was banned in China. They don't like your model. So can you get into this broader perspective of what people globally should be thinking about? You know, how does it different? How does it differ in your privacy rights in the U.S. versus other countries and what you're giving up? And how does Maple help protect against those potential scenarios?
Yeah, I generally want to look at AI as a tool. It's a tool that you can use to do things in your life to help you out. And I look at a tool like a hammer. I look at a tool like a glass that's holding my water right now that I'm drinking. And I don't really see a reason for the government to be involved in that process. It doesn't matter if it's the U.S. government or any government around the world, right? They don't really need to be involved in between me and this glass that I'm using to drink water. I could boil my own water. I could do things to like sanitize my own water. They don't necessarily need to be involved there. And I look at AI as something similar. We constantly, a lot of people are talking about how can the government regulate this? How can the government get involved? And I think if you're living globally, wherever you are, whatever country you're in, look at your government's track record and maybe how they've dealt with other things with human liberties, civil liberties, and human rights and freedoms that have happened within your country. And do you want them involved in your new frontier of technology that you're stepping into with AI? And all of the access that it's going to have, because AI is going to have access to all the data on your computer, all the data on your phone. Eventually, it's going to have access to the most valuable data, which is your brain. And so do you want government to have that opportunity to be in there? Because whenever they get in there, they have an opportunity to stop you or to allow you and be a gatekeeper. And do they have any reason really for being involved at that step? I've talked to organizations and activist groups who have been working on very sensitive cases for children in other countries who are, you know, with human trafficking and other awful things that go on. And when they deal with files and they upload them maybe to a certain cloud server, they have found that those files get leaked to the oppressors that they're actually fighting against for the freedom of these children. And so you really have to trust that if you're going to upload something, that it's not going to get into the hands of the person that you're fighting against. And really the best way to guarantee that is to use these tools that we have of encryption and verifiability and open source code to make sure that really you know end to end how your data is being handled so that you aren't just giving it out there and just hoping for the best. I don't want to just hope for the best. I want to like have more assurances for the best.
I mean, I think we've done a great job highlighting all of the, I guess, dangers, let's call it, of the centralized models. And if anyone listening, I mean, if you're still haven't quite gotten that, re-listen to the first 30 minutes of this, or, you know, Google, or better yet, ask Maple AI about social networks and populism. And let's just give that as a foregone conclusion. We're aware that this is extremely delicate and important. And now, you know, kind of bridging this to your product, you know, the potential for something like private AI such as Maple, you know, I think it's curious because so when I look at Bitcoin, the Bitcoin white paper, I think what it mostly has taught us is where there's centralized power that can be corrupted, it will be corrupted. And so, you know, in the case of Bitcoin, that's applied to, you know, to money. But, you know, the same thing goes for these AI models, given everything you just explained. And here we are, and Bitcoin is a $2 trillion, roughly, market cap asset. There's clearly been a lot of demand for this decentralized model, for, you know, this movement towards sovereignty and privacy. So I do feel like we're moving into a direction where people are seeing the massive benefits of these tools, of these, you know, being able to keep your sovereignty, being able to keep your data, your privacy. And I'm wondering how you look at Maple AI's market potential, let's say. What are you seeing? Who's demanding this privacy AI?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you want to talk about like what are the great potentials? One of the amazing things about Bitcoin is that it gave people the opportunity to chart their own course, right? Be your own bank is the phrase that people love to use, right? And it sounds kind of silly, but when you actually like go through the motions and you become your own bank, you suddenly realize like the freedoms that are opened up to you because you're not depending on all these other organizations now to make your own choices, make your own decisions. And so the decentralized nature of Bitcoin enables that. And so we've taken those same philosophies and we really built them into Maple, where you can kind of be in your own AI room and you can be your own AI. And the decentralized nature that we brought to it is with all these different open source models from these massive companies and other organizations that are competing with each other to have the best thing out there. We bring them all in and we let you as the user choose what you want to work with. And so we have quick models, we have image models, we have reasoning models, we have math analytical models, programming. And we try to decentralize the kind of the reasoning there rather than just depending on one that is put out by Anthropic only and driving everybody to there. As far as like who are the early users, we see awesome, great, big opportunity here as well. Our biggest users to start have been in the legal industry, accounting. We have financial professionals doing like financial advisory. And then we have a lot of therapists who are using the platform. And these are all people that are used to dealing with very sensitive information already in their day job. They go into a room with somebody, they close the door and they have a private conversation with them. And then they don't go out to the bar afterwards and talk about all this private information that they just chatted with their client to everybody at the bar, because they understand there is a barrier there that needs to be preserved and of confidentiality. And so we've built the tool for them to do that within the AI space. And so they are finding us and coming to us and using us. And they're some of our most active users. The interesting thing about running a privacy-oriented company is that you don't really know a lot about your users. So we depend on people who are open with us. Either they email us or they post online and they're okay talking about being Maple users. But over half of our Maple users are using privacy-preserving email addresses. So they're using an alias. We don't know who they are. We don't know what company they're with. Or they're buying our most anonymous plan. We have this anonymous account where we don't actually accept credit card payments for this one because credit cards are a highly surveilled network. So you can only pay for those with Bitcoin. It's really similar to the Molvad VPN approach, where you click a button for an anonymous account. We generate a unique account ID for you. You write down that ID because we don't keep it afterwards. If you lose that ID, you lose access to your account. And then you pay for it with Bitcoin, and you can go, you know, on-chain Bitcoin, Lightning. You can use eCash over Lightning, Arc, all these other layer twos, and you can find your way to preserve your privacy. And so in that regard, there are a lot of our users that we just don't know. So there might be people using Maple for other purposes and getting immense value out of it. And we haven't been able to find out what they're doing because we don't want to pry. But we would love to make it better for them. And so we have some very active users, some of our top users on the platform usage wise. We don't know who they are and we don't know what they're doing, but they seem to love it because they're just constantly in there every single day using it.
I'd like to touch on payments a little bit too, because Tony, your co-founder, who we've alluded to in the conversation, but not specifically called him out as your co-founder, he has a background in Lightning. In working on Lightning protocol and related to Bitcoin, how are you two thinking about the trajectory of integrating Bitcoin into AI? I mean, I currently it feels like if you want more advanced AI usage, you pay a monthly fee, and what the conversations that Israel and I have had. We see the potential for a deeper integration with agentic AI, where as you become a little bit more personalized in the use of it, maybe you have a task and that task is paid for in sats, small denominations of Bitcoin, that allow you to pay per use for, and I guess maybe this goes to the use of Bitcoin for payment. It also allows payment by individuals or in jurisdictions where credit cards are not as common, or where if they don't have a credit card. So it allows more people to use these LLMs or AI tools without having to have a bank account or credit card, and they can use them by using Bitcoin. So how are you thinking about payments, both with Maple AI and even the future of pay-per use of AI?
Yeah, no, my co-founder, Tony, has like a ton of experience building on Bitcoin. He has built a lot of the most cutting-edge technologies you could, and dealt with all the hairy problems that come along with that. So it's a space that we understand very well. And for that, we do accept Bitcoin as payment for it for Maple. And we follow the subscription route for now. Now, you mentioned agentic AI. And for people who keep hearing that word, but maybe don't know what it is, it's really just an AI that runs in the background for you. Right now, most people, their experience with AI is they land on a screen and there is a box that says, what do you want to do today? Or how can I help you? And you must type something in and then hit go. And depending on how much or how little you type in is going to affect what you get out of that experience. And a lot of people are frustrated, actually, when they first finally try AI, because they don't understand that they need to give it more information. And so they're told all these promises where it's like, oh, I just like typed in a few words and a vibe coded this entire app for me, and now I'm making millions of dollars. Like, that's not really what AI does. You need to give it a lot of really rich information and directions. So when you look at agentic AI, what's really cool here, and this is a space that we're working on with Maple, the future version of Maple is not going to look like it is right now. We're moving more into the agentic space as well, where it's going to be this thing that's running in the background that has access to your data, and it's going to come to you and prompt you. It flips the table, right? Where it comes to you and says, hey, there's this thing that happened overnight while you were sleeping. I think you should take this action next. Here's my recommendation, right? Or over time, you've built up this relationship with it where you give it permission to take that action for you. And maybe you set a budget for it or something, or you have parameters so it doesn't just go crazy. But that's the world that we're moving into. I think 2026 is going to be huge for agentic AI. And then especially 27 is probably where a lot of it really hits mainstream. But in that world, like you talked about, I think we need something more pay-per-use, where we need to have this ability for agents to pay each other for services. I am not going to sign up for a subscription for 100 different agentic AIs, right? No, I want to have them. I just want to give money to mine and say, hey, wherever you go, if you need to pay for a service, just, you know, pay for that little bit that you use. So that's going to totally change how this is working. And I don't think the subscription model goes away. I think, I might pay for a subscription to like this main service that I use, but then it has to go out and pay for other services in the background to chat with them. So there's going to be all sorts of cool, different creative business models that come up. But the question is, like, how do we pay for all that stuff? What technology do we use? And we've had credit cards that have been around for decades, and they're this old payment system that doesn't really lend itself to micropayments, like, at all. Whereas we have this newer technology of Bitcoin and then the Lightning Network and eCash and Spark and Arc. And I mean, you could go on and on with all the different platforms. We have this new ability to pay one penny or lower, one sat, really, right? And so that, I think we're going to look at these two competing technologies, and I'm really interested to see which one wins there. I think Bitcoin is the better technology. I think that Lightning is a better technology and other layers that are being built. But I also understand that there is this entire industry of incumbents who have a lot of money invested, and they're going to try and come at this from their side and try to win this battle and be the payments platform for AI. And so I don't know who's going to win there, but I do know which one's a better technology, and which is on the Bitcoin side. And so I think that we need people building on this side to figure out how do we solve this problem. I know there are people building in this space. One of them is Jordy over at FewSats, who's trying to build around this L402 concept. And also in the AI space, how do we solve that? There's so many others building there too. So to me, that's where, like, if you're getting into Bitcoin building now and you're wanting to like work on the new frontier, the frontier of Bitcoin AI is still undefined. There's a lot of overlap in thought process, a lot of overlap in ethos, But if you want to get practical, how do I build something? Figuring out how to do Bitcoin agentic payments with small micropayments on Bitcoin is going to be an incredible space. And there's going to be plenty of market for that in my mind, or plenty of need, I should say, in the future.
I am pretty confident that Bitcoin is going to win. I mean, I understand your positioning, but I mean, it's specifically because of what you mentioned, because it is the better technology, right? I mean, I think in my view, the timeline is a little certain. I'm sure the incumbents will, you know, push and fight back on this, and you know that might take a little more time, but ultimately I think in the general progress of humanity, better technology just wins out, right? And especially if it's, you know, decentralized, open. I mean, what you just mentioned is fascinating. I remember it was one of our early episodes, a company called Thunder. I don't know if you're familiar with them, Mark, but we interviewed them. They're in the gaming industry, and they're handling micropayments, of course, using Bitcoin. And the reason I bring it up is because, you know, they talked about how lots of these companies need to pay, and a lot of their users are international customers. And sometimes, you know, maybe you're looking at a, you know, 67 cent payout, let's just say. And like, that's just literally kind of impossible currently in the fiat world, right? I mean, you can't make a 67 cent cross-border payment just because the economics don't work out. And, you know, they might, the incumbents, to your point, you know, they might, of course, we have this whole stablecoin, you know, wave coming, and they might try to compete with other, you know, alternative private blockchains and stablecoins. But ultimately, I mean, you're still in the KYC'd fiat intermediated world. I just don't see the agentic and micropayment side of things going to the fiat technologies. I just don't. But I mean, it's fascinating, because when you look at something like Maple AI, for example, and agentic AI, I mean, you're retaining that privacy, you're retaining your data, you can get more personal with it, as you're describing. And so that's, I think, where the true benefits of AI as a technology come, right? I mean, you mentioned it's a tool, which I agree. And it's I think the potential for what you guys are building is just it's just massive and inspiring, because that's the direction we need to go. Yeah, sorry, bit of a rant there, but
no, that's cool. And I think I've got a kind of a follow along there with to continue your rant a bit. And that is, people like to ask in the investor space. I'm chatting with investors all the time, and constantly get asked, is this privacy space big enough to invest in? Right. And what I love to point at is, you have, so we've been called the Signal of AI. A lot of people are calling us that. And so I started looking at Signal, and I looked at Proton, because somebody else was like, oh, you're kind of like Proton for AI, even though they have their own AI product. Ours is better, and they're great. I like the Proton people. I'm like not throwing shade at them. That's just objectively where we're at right now. But I looked at both Signal and Proton, and the best estimates that I can find when doing a lot of market research is that they have captured roughly 2% to 5% of their overall markets. So Signal in the text messaging space, Proton in email, and now they're getting more into like Google Workspace stuff. So 2 to 5%. If you look at something like Maple and you look at Gen AI, by 2030, Gen AI, I mean, it's all over the board, but let's just land on $300 billion industry. And so if you look at 2 to 5% of that market, that's like a $5 billion to $15 billion company. That's not a small company, right? That's like revenue coming in the door. So the opportunity is very large for someone to come in and be the, quote, Signal of AI. And that's really where we're building right now. But I also can understand that privacy, for just an everyday consumer, privacy is not like the selling feature for most people. They want convenience, which is why we marched down this whole road of social media and cloud software to begin with, and where we're marching now with ChatGPT. So Maple is looking to not just be the private thing. We're trying to be the most convenient thing for you, so you can have the most personal experience and the most effective AI experience. And that is solely enabled because of the privacy and because of the verifiability and the open source nature of Maple. So you're going to see a lot of really interesting things come out of Maple over the next year, where we get more into just this everyday consumer user experience that makes their life easier and is more convenient for them. And they're picking Maple because it's convenient. Their friend is recommending to them because they're like, oh, it's doing this thing for me. And privacy isn't actually mentioned in the conversation. But that feature is only possible, that convenience is only possible because of the privacy nature that we have. So that's really where we're headed.
Yeah. I mean, and I think also when you have that comparison of Signal and some of the other more private messaging, they came late in the game, really, when you think about it. It's like WhatsApp and messages had already taken off so much. And then we realized that we needed privacy. And same thing, you know, I think with this Gen AI movement, we're still at very early stages of it. And so I think it's a perfect time to create greater awareness of why you need to consider this. And to your point, there are a number of industries where it's just a natural that if they're not using it because of privacy concerns, now all of a sudden they can have the benefits of the productivity that these models provide and still retain the privacy for their clients and for their business models and things like this. So I think it's just an awareness game. But I do want to talk a little bit about your company growth as we're kind of hitting some time. Is it still just you and Tony working on it? Or what is your, what are you hiring other developers? Or what is your trajectory? What's your future as you're building out these new features? What is your roadmap look like?
It is just the two of us still. We're living the meme, which is we're using AI to help us do more with just the two of us. And we officially launched Maple at the end of January this year. So looking back 11 months, you know, almost to the day right now as we're recording this, as people listening to this, it's almost a year ago. And we have gone from no users to, you know, many users in that time frame. We are already almost on our way to profitability, just being the two of us. We've kept our cash burn really low. And so in 2026, by the end of 2026, we will likely be a profitable company if we just stay us two. Now, we want to grow bigger than that. We want to grow faster than that. And so we're looking to raise money so that we can hire more people. We would love to hire 5 to 7 people. My kids want me to say 6 to 7 people, you know, over the next year. But we want to hire some more people to help us with engineering. We have some really ambitious engineering goals that we want to tackle with this whole convenience, agentic AI, personal agentic AI space. But then we also need to bring on a designer. We should bring on somebody with marketing because I'm the person doing marketing and I'm not that great at it. So we have a lot of people that we want to bring on to help us really scale this thing because we're going up against some of the biggest names in the industry. And that's where our head is at right now. We've got great traction. Every month we're growing month over month with revenue. We're growing month over month with users. We have amazing retention with our paid users. We're much better than the industry from what I can tell as we go out and look at the numbers that have been published. We're below 10% on our churn rate with our paid users. So we have really good retention and people love us. In fact, what we saw is we recently launched a live web search feature. So most people forget this. We talked just a second ago about how fast the space moves. Most people forget that just about a year ago, none of these AIs had live data, or maybe a year and a half ago. They were all these models that have been trained on like 2-year-old information. And so when you chatted with it, you had to like give it all the new information if you wanted it to be current. And it was only like a year and a half ago where they started to add web search into these AIs. So we got that with Maple. Now you can chat and get current information brought in. And what we saw when we introduced that is our paid usage like started to shoot up through the roof. Users who had been paying for the service, who had been casually using it, are now using it on a daily basis. Our daily active users have gone up a lot, our monthly active users. So we're seeing that people not only are happy to pay for the product, but are actively finding a lot of value out of it every day. So those are great, strong signals to us. Now the goal is let's grow the funnel. Let's get more people to know about Maple because there's not enough people know about it. And then let's keep building really good features that bring more convenience to people and bring more value to their everyday life.
Well, I mean, congrats on everything that you both have accomplished. And it sounds like you're on a very promising trajectory. First of all, thanks for the time, Mark. And it's just such an important topic and you're building out an amazing product. Any last comments that you want to leave us with?
Sure. My invitation to everybody here. First off, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate this conversation. This has been a very different take on this typical AI conversation that I have with people, and it's been very enjoyable. My invitation to the listener here is I'm not asking you to like get rid of ChatGPT or get rid of these other services you have, but rather download Maple and stick it in a folder next to your other AI apps. And then chat with both, chat with Anthropic Claude or chat with ChatGPT, and then go into Maple and chat there and just kind of see the difference of how you feel afterwards and see the kind of things that you can talk about and they feel comfortable talking about. My hunch is that you're going to feel like you can be more yourself when you use Maple. So keep it as a tool in your toolbox. Just have it there ready for you when you need it. And if you only use it part of the time, or if you eventually move over and make it your main driver, amazing if you do, but I just want people to have that extra tool that can be there for them. So go to our website. It's trymaple.ai, or you can find us on the App Store for both Apple and Google. It's Maple AI with the green leaf on the icon. And grab it and try it out. Yeah, really appreciate it.
This is a fascinating conversation. I'm sure it's not going to be our last one. We'd love to follow the continued trajectory of Maple AI and the new tools that you're going to bring out. And just are there any words that you can offer of why Bitcoin communities and AI communities need to come together a little bit more or integrate a little bit more?
Yeah, I think obviously from my perspective, The whole verifiability that Bitcoiners have is really crucial for AI as we move into this AI space. And a lot of AI people are talking about that now. But I don't think, because they don't come from this place that we have with Bitcoin, they don't have the framework to discuss. So you see a lot of ideas being discussed that have been already argued ad nauseum on Bitcoin mailing list or argued at Bitcoin conferences or in meetups for years. I mean, over 10 years now, we've been talking about these kinds of things. And the AI space is starting to broach some of these topics. And so when you have built a Lightning wallet that runs on someone's phone that holds their money, and you have to make sure you don't lose their funds, or you build something that's holding their life savings on some other software product, when you've had to solve that problem and had to be very careful and methodical about how you handle that data, you learn some things and you have a different approach to software that maybe the typical, you know, move fast and break things nature does not have. And so I would love to see the Bitcoin world and the AI world come together more, because I think we both have a lot to offer each other. And so that's really, I think, why Maple is being so successful early on, is because we've come from this space where we understand just the true importance of dealing with people's sovereign data and making sure we don't mess it up.
Well, Mark, thanks again. And finally, where can people get in touch or find you?
Yeah, you can find me. I'm on Noster, Marks at primal.net. I'm also on X. You can just go to @MarkSuman. And then just find us on trymaple.ai, and you can contact us through there. We've got GitHub on there. We have Discord on there if people want to join our Discord community. We try to make ourselves very available for people to reach out. So yeah, please reach out, ping me, and I should respond.
We appreciate it, Mark. Until next time.
Great. Thank you
so much.